Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Innovations in Cardiac PET Imaging. This CME activity was developed to be distributed on Medscape. Copyright by MedXL. This activity is certified by USF Health and presented by Gary V. Heller, MD, PhD, Timothy M. Bateman, MD, and Sharmila Dorbala, MD. Dr. Heller is a chair, professor of medicine and nuclear medicine, University of Connecticut School of Medicine, associate director, cardiology, director, nuclear cardiology, director, cardiovascular fellowship program, Hartford Hospital, Hartford, Connecticut. Dr. Heller has made the following disclosures: grant and/or research support from Astellas and Bracco Diagnostics, advisory board and/or panel, Lantheus. Dr. Bateman is a professor of medicine, University of Missouri School of Medicine, co-director, cardiovascular radiologic imaging, Mid-America Heart Institute at St. Luke's Hospital, Kansas City, Missouri. Dr. Bateman has made the following disclosures: grant and/or research support from Astellas, Bracco Diagnostics, GE Healthcare, Philips, and Spectrum Dynamics, advisory board and/or panel, Astellas, GE Healthcare, Lantheus, and Spectrum Dynamics, stock and/or shareholder, Cardiovascular Imaging Technologies, and Spectrum Dynamics. Dr. Dorbala is an assistant professor of radiology, Harvard Medical School, director of nuclear cardiology, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Dorbala has made the following disclosures: grant and/or research support from Amyloid Foundation, Astellas, and National Institutes of Health, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, advisory board and/or panel, Astellas. With the clinical impact in diagnosis, prognosis, and assessment of cardiac diseases and conditions, positron emission tomography has become a much-needed tool for cardiology practice. Moreover, as evidence increases regarding the role of PET in the clinical translation of novel concepts of molecular medicine and personalized medicine, cardiology and nuclear imaging professionals need to stay abreast of these emerging concepts related to PET that will improve the practice of cardiology. These professionals must become familiar with PET utilization, benefits, recent clinical guidelines, and future directions of application. This activity is supported by Astellas. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Gary Heller, Professor of Medicine at the University of Connecticut and Associate Director of the Division of Cardiology and Director of Nuclear Cardiology at Hartford Hospital. I'd like to welcome you to the spotlight activity, Innovations in Cardiac PET Imaging. This activity is jointly sponsored by USF Health and MedXL and is supported by an educational grant from Astellas. I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Dr. Timothy Bateman, Professor of Medicine and Co-Director of Cardiovascular Radiologic Imaging, Cardiovascular Consultants, and Mid-America Heart Institute at St. Luke's Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri, as well as Dr. Sharmila Dorbala, who is Assistant Professor of Radiology at Harvard Medical School and Director of Nuclear Cardiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. I'd like to introduce Dr. Bateman, who will discuss the objectives of this activity.
The objectives for this activity are to describe the clinical impact of contemporary cardiac PET imaging, to examine recent advances in PET imaging, and to discuss the implementation of PET imaging in clinical practice. We will be discussing the clinical value and distinguishing features of PET, advances in PET imaging, and finally the business aspects and future of nuclear cardiology. I'd like to call now on Dr. Gary Heller to compare for us myocardial perfusion PET and SPECT imaging. Gary?
Thank you, Dr. Bateman. In recent years, cardiac PET perfusion imaging has exploded in the nuclear cardiology arena, growing from approximately 25 sites around 8 years ago to somewhere around 170 sites currently. There are several reasons for this, because of the advantages of PET myocardial perfusion imaging compared to SPECT, such as higher spatial resolution, greater counting efficiencies, higher diagnostic accuracy, robust attenuation correction, a much shorter protocol, as well as additional information that can be garnered from PET perfusion imaging studies. A recent meta-analysis of 19 studies demonstrated a very high sensitivity and specificity for PET imaging, particularly in regards to overall diagnostic accuracy, as well as that of individual coronary territories. Recent data has also compared both PET and SPECT in similar, although not the same, patients. In this study by Bateman and colleagues, the diagnostic accuracy for both the overall study as well as individual vascular territory in each group was significantly higher for PET in comparison to SPECT imaging. Furthermore, if one evaluates gender and body mass, this diagnostic accuracy continued to favor PET over SPECT, both in terms of male and female patients, as well as body mass index less than and greater than 30. Finally, the multi-vessel sensitivity, in other words, the ability of PET imaging to correctly identify patients with multi-vessel disease, is significantly higher than with SPECT imaging. In general, this means there's a wide applicability beyond obese patients. There's also additional information that can be garnered from a PET imaging study. This includes transient ischemic cavity dilation, reversible wall motion abnormalities at rest and stress, calcium scoring when available, and finally, an exciting new area of regional and global myocardial blood flow. An example of this is in the next slide. However, Dr. Drobala will give us more information in a few moments. It's clear in this particular case, a patient who has completely normal perfusion as well as normal myocardial blood flow, this patient not only has a normal study, but the likelihood of coronary disease and particularly three-vessel or missed ischemia or balanced ischemia is substantially lower than just looking at perfusion alone. Who would benefit from PET perfusion imaging? Obviously, this is undergoing some clinical thought process right now, but here's a few things to think about. One is pharmacologic stress patients. Because of the lower radiation exposure, ease of the test, almost any patient undergoing pharmacologic stress would benefit from PET rather than SPECT imaging. In those patients in whom exercise is possible, NH3 ammonia could be a solution. Clearly, obese patients benefit from PET imaging, as well as equivocal SPECT studies. Patients who have a high likelihood of known coronary artery disease may also be perfect candidates for PET. And finally, those patients in whom you suspect the myocardial blood flow is impaired, such as diabetic patients and those with hypertension, may also be excellent candidates for PET perfusion imaging.
So, Dr. Heller, you've reviewed for us patients who are good candidates for a PET scan. Who, in your opinion, is not a good candidate for PET imaging?
I believe PET imaging is actually pretty widely applicable. However, there are some patients in whom the suspicion of coronary disease is relatively low, such as a male patient, 55, and whom has excellent exercise capacity. Recent advancements in the SPECT world have suggested that doing a stress-only study, particularly with attenuation correction, is a very fast and efficient protocol. So in that case, one can do a very efficient protocol with SPECT. On the other hand, more complex patients, I think, would benefit from PET perfusion imaging.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the advantages of pharmacologic PET outweigh the benefit of exercise stress testing?
That's an interesting question. Primarily in our lab, we always ask the first question of whether the patient can exercise. And if the patient can exercise and requires myocardial perfusion imaging, then those patients preferably undergo SPECT myocardial perfusion imaging with exercise stress. However, there are certain patients who are able to exercise but still may need a PET perfusion imaging. For instance, recently we had a patient who was 34, who had cardiac transplant, had an angiogram suggestive of transplant vasculopathy. And the 34-year-old was able to exercise, yet we decided to perform a cardiac PET with vasodilator stress, primarily to evaluate myocardial blood flow in that individual.
I'd also say from our perspective that the patients in whom you have a very high suspicion of coronary disease, and particularly those in whom you do an exercise SPECT and you're not completely satisfied with the results of that test, then you might want to think, if that SPECT is normal, what am I going to do? PET perfusion imaging, because it has a higher diagnostic accuracy, and particularly with blood flow that we'll be discussing later on, may be an advantage even in a patient in whom exercise is possible.
So, Dr. Darbella, are there some specific patients who you would not refer for a PET scan?
Yes, indeed. Some patients do have clinical indications for PET, but yet may not be candidates. For instance, we do sometimes get referred patients who are extremely obese, who may not fit on the scanner table. We also have patients who are not as heavy, but may not fit inside the scanner gantry with their arms raised up. Occasionally, we also do come across patients with severe heart failure with increased circulation time. And those patients with rubidium, we tend to see more blood pool activity with less resolution between the myocardium and the blood pool. With ammonia, what we've noticed sometimes is patients with heart failure, the increased lung uptake may come very close to the myocardium and interfere with the imaging occasionally. I don't know if Dr. Heller has any other suggestions.
Another one in our laboratory, patients who have claustrophobia. We have a PET CT camera, and patients walk into the lab and walk out of the lab because there is no way that they can get into the camera without extreme anxiety. Patients who have who are very nervous for some reason or are somewhat unstable, we think motion is a real problem because the ability to identify motion during either the CT or the PET study is challenging.
Yeah, I agree, actually. With patient motion, sometimes we have a tough time deciding whether to do SPECT or PET. And if we make an assessment that it's unpredictable, that the patient may or may not cooperate with imaging, then those patients we try to go with SPECT because we have the option of re-scanning the patient if there's motion. But if not, if the patient is able to cooperate for 5 to 7 minutes, those patients would try to do PET imaging. Mm-hmm.
If you have a very large patient, but not morbidly obese, but will fit in the PET camera, would you prefer to do those patients with a two-day SPECT or a PET?
The very large patients who can exercise, it really depends on the referring clinician's interest and the patient's ability to exercise. If the patient is able to fit on a treadmill and able to exercise, we will sometimes do an exercise. But of course, if the imaging part is important, which it is in most of these cases, then those cases may be scheduled for a PET with vasodilator stress.
Well, this is a terrific discussion. Let's move on to another topic in PET, and that is recent advancements in PET imaging. Dr. Darbella.
Thank you, Dr. Heller. So there's several advances in cardiac PET imaging. As we all know, cardiac PET has been around for over 2 decades now. For this discussion, I will focus on two clinically applicable advances. First, I'll discuss the value of quantitative myocardial blood flow assessment. Quantitation of absolute myocardial blood flow has been possible for several decades using a technique called dynamic image acquisition and using kinetic modeling techniques. Myocardial blood flow is computed at rest and during vasodilator stress. Coronary flow reserve is then calculated as a ratio of stress myocardial blood flow to rest myocardial blood flow. Absolute quantitation of myocardial blood flow can be helpful to identify severe and extensive coronary artery disease, as well as to identify coronary microvascular dysfunction in patients with risk factors with or without coexistent epicardial coronary artery disease. How is this used clinically? In this example, I show images of a patient showing ischemia in the distribution of the left anterior descending coronary artery. This is a large and reversible perfusion defect involving the entire anterior wall, septum, and apex. However, when we review the coronary flow reserve shown in a polar plot format to the right of the image, abnormal flow reserve less than 2, is apparent in the left circumflex as well as the right coronary artery distributions, along with the LAD distribution. This patient went on to have invasive angiography, which confirmed severe multivessel coronary artery disease. Several groups have reported on the prognostic value of absolute myocardial blood flow assessment imaged non-invasively using PET. The largest and the most recent study is from our institution, in which we included 2783 patients who underwent clinically indicated rubidium 82 PET CT imaging. All of these patients were followed up for a median of 1.4 years. The primary endpoint of this study was cardiac death. The results of this study demonstrated that when compared to patients with flow reserve in the upper tertile, patients in the lowest tertile of coronary flow reserve had the highest risk of cardiac death, while those in the middle tertile of coronary flow reserve had an intermediate risk of cardiac death. In this figure, we demonstrate the improved risk assessment with coronary flow reserve measurement. As you can see here, on the top row is the pre-CFR risk, in the middle row is the post-CFR risk, and in the bottom row is the annualized cardiac mortality. In green is the low pre-CFR risk, in blue is the intermediate CFR risk, and in red is the high CFR risk. What you see here is that once we know the CFR information, among the low-risk patients, 16% are classified as intermediate risk, and at the bottom you can see that these individuals have a cardiac mortality risk of 1.7%, which is higher than the individuals that remain low-risk after the CFR information is added. In the intermediate risk group, you will notice that about half of the patients are reclassified, a smaller proportion into high-risk and a slightly larger proportion into low-risk. And at the bottom, you'll notice that in the group of the patients reclassified into a higher risk, the event rate is over 4%, whereas in the group of patients who are classified into lower risk, the event rate is 0.2%. And at the right, you note patients with high CFR, high risk, and CFR classifies a small proportion of the high-risk individuals. And accordingly, you will notice that among the patients who are reclassified into a low risk, shown in green, 3%, the event rate is extremely low. Some patients from the high-risk group were reclassified into intermediate risk group, and you will see that there was a concomitant lower event rate, 1.4%, in this group of individuals compared to the individuals who remained in high risk, and these individuals had a risk of more than 10%. The next graph here shows images, rest and exercise stress images of a patient who underwent N13 ammonia PET CT imaging. This patient was 53 years old, presented with typical anginal symptoms. The scan demonstrates a large and reversible perfusion defect and significant ischemia in all three vascular distributions. Exercise PET imaging is feasible with N13 ammonia, and it offers the advantages of providing exercise information, hemodynamic information, as well as perfusion information. However, the use of N13 ammonia for PET is limited at present only to sites that have an on-site cyclotron. And the other matter that we face clinically is that we have to very tightly coordinate the delivery of the dose of ammonia to the exercise stress because of its 9-minute half-life. This slide shows a comparison of the image quality between F18 BMS, presently called F18 fluorpyridaz, and N13 ammonia images in a patient with normal myocardial perfusion imaging. A new radiotracer, F18 fluorpyridaz, is currently under development. It has a half-life of about 2 hours and can be transported as a unit dose to sites without a cyclotron. This tracer allows for imaging with pharmacologic or exercise stress. Clinical trials are currently underway, and this tracer may be available for clinical use within the next few years. The last slide here demonstrates images of a cardiac sarcoid study. In addition to assessment of myocardial viability, F18-FDG can be used to evaluate for cardiac inflammation. For this study, for cardiac sarcoid assessment, patients typically undergo first a perfusion study with either rubidium or technetium-99m SPECT, followed by an F18-FDG study. Patients undergo a special dietary preparation with high-fat and low-carbohydrate diet to suppress glucose utilization by the normal myocytes. Inflamed myocytes take up FDG, and a hotspot imaging is performed.
Give us a little sense for how you use CFR in your laboratory right now. You present us some very intriguing data, but on a day-to-day basis, how do you do it, and do you report it to referring physicians?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question that we struggle with all the time. Of course, there's several options. One option is to report in all patients, but then we are faced with the question of how do referring physicians use this information to clinically manage patients? The most important concern that we have in that regard is if you do have patients with decreased coronary flow reserve, we want to make sure that the referring physicians don't send all of them to coronary angiography. So the primary problem that we face with is to educate the referring physicians about how to use the CFR information effectively in patient management.
So it's kind of an ongoing situation, right?
It's an ongoing situation.
For example, diabetic patients, I would think you'd have a number of patients with abnormal CFR who might have microvascular disease.
Absolutely. There's several subgroups of patients in whom we do have absolute flow values that are abnormal. At this time, we are only reporting out in the clinical report when the physician specifically asks for the CFR. So there's special instances where the doctor will call us and say, we would like to schedule a cardiac PET study to get a quantitative flow estimate, either because patient has suspicion, either because they have a suspicion of microvascular disease or angiogram shows diffuse disease, or they suspect microvascular disease.
Okay, so it's sort of an evolution. Now, Dr. Bateman has also been doing CFR and a number of patients. So give us your sense as to how you're using it clinically.
Very much the same, actually. I think CFR measurements are very helpful in almost all patients, with the exception of very complicated patients. So patients with shunts, with valvular heart disease, with advanced cardiomyopathy, I think these flow measurements are not validated currently. But otherwise, it's very helpful in situations where you're concerned potentially about an antagonist, such as caffeine. It's very helpful to see a normal scan and also recognize that blood flow reserve was substantially increased.
So in that particular case, would you report that out to the physician, or how do you do that? You don't report all of them, or?
Yes, we report them on the extremes. So if coronary flow reserve is normal, we report all of those. If it is very abnormal, we report all of those. We're not quite sure what recommendation to make in terms of patient follow-up if CFR is in the range of 1.8, for example.
Okay. So just another topic in terms of developments. Myocardial viability is obviously a big issue, particularly with recent data. So just briefly, can you give us a sense for both of your laboratories, what do you think is a candidate for an FDG viability study? Dr. Dabala?
That's a very interesting question, particularly now that we have the results of the STITCH trial. So how do we deal with this? I think I have not seen a big change in referral pattern at the Brigham at this point based on the recent study results. We still do perform viability assessment, but typically the patients that we see referred to us for viability assessment are not the STITCH candidates. They're not people who are amenable to revascularization or medical therapy. Most of them are either too sick for surgery or don't have good distal targets, where the doctor's debating whether or not surgery would be a good option.
Well, that's a very important point. I would also, I don't believe that FDG PET was part of the STITCH trial, so it's sort of an unknown as to how that fits into those candidates.
Absolutely. FDG PET and cardiac MRI were both not part of the study. The study only included SPECT perfusion imaging with thallium rest and delayed enhancement, as well as low-dose dobutamine echo. Our center is primarily an FDG PET center for viability assessment.
So, Dr. Bailey?
I'd like to add that there's growing information in the literature to indicate that patients with chronic total occlusions, even with relatively normal ventricular function, may benefit from revascularization if that myocardium is viable. And we're starting to see increasing referrals for those types of patients. The question is really whether cardiac MR or FDG PET will answer that question more accurately.
So it's interesting in our lab, too, post-stitch is a word. We're actually seeing more referrals for FDG, but they're very targeted. Like, what about the LAD territory? Can you help us out on that? And I think FDG imaging is actually, if anything, becoming more important.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, let's move on to the last discussion by Dr. Bateman, and that is the business aspects and future of nuclear cardiology. Tim?
Well, the field of nuclear cardiology, and thanks for asking me to speak on this topic, Gary. There are many negative forces affecting the field of nuclear cardiology today, and these are the three big ones, I think, affecting the success of the field. Radiation exposure, downward pressure on payments, and therefore the necessity for us to find ways to reduce expenditures for performance of our tests, and finally the need for newer applications. So how does PET fit in to these challenges? So radiation exposure is obviously a growing public concern in the U.S. The average annual exposure is now estimated at 6.2 millisieverts, and about a quarter of that is coming from medical imaging. So that's why we need to consider dosimetry in imaging test selection. So by far the most common protocol for myocardial perfusion imaging today is rest stress sestamibi, and that is associated with about 12 millisieverts of effective total body dose. The two approved PET agents reduce this exposure to approximately 25% to 30% of that SPECT protocol. And this is why the ASNC recently released an information statement favoring PET as a first-line choice for perfusion imaging when PET scanning is available. The second major challenge today is to control costs. Providers, of course, have no control over payments, and payments are decreasing, so providers can exert some control over costs, and this needs to be thought about. Radionuclides today, for the most part, are bundled into the global payment. So being able to use less radionuclide, for example, with solid-state detectors is something that people should be thinking about. Increasing efficiency is another way to reduce costs, and that is possible predominantly with solid-state SPECT and with myocardial perfusion PET. Both of these offer substantial advantages in throughput efficiency. And finally is the need for new applications of myocardial perfusion imaging. In my mind, the most exciting current new application in perfusion imaging is the ability to quantitate flow, and we've already discussed this in some detail. So in conclusion then, there's a growing chorus to significantly reduce radiation exposure in perfusion imaging. This will require either markedly reduced utilization or a change of instrumentation to higher sensitivity detectors so that we can use much lower dosages, or to PET where there is much lower radiation exposure. We also need to reduce expenditures in order to control our costs. That this will require either smaller dosages of radionuclides or market improvement in efficiency. And finally, I would conjecture that PET will likely absorb an increasing percentage of more complicated patients. It's quite possible that the typical nuclear cardiology lab of the near future could include a solid-state SPECT for more straightforward, lower likelihood patients who can exercise, and a PET camera for more complicated situations.
Thank you, Tim. A couple questions. First is, we've been talking about several different radiopharmaceuticals, such as ammonia, rubidium, and the new F-18 agent. So give us a perspective on where you think those will be in the next few years.
Sure. Well, first of all, rubidium, as you have heard, is predominantly limited to patients who can undergo pharmacologic stress. So one of the differences between ammonia and flurpyridaz is that those two agents will also be very effective for patients who can exercise. The second comment is that rubidium, because it entails a high monthly fixed cost, will be most applicable to high-volume labs. So smaller labs and labs that are interested in exercising patients will probably migrate more to either ammonia or to flurpyridaz. It is interesting that with the recent temporary withdrawal of rubidium, that some labs have adopted ammonia imaging, and many of those labs are indicating quite high satisfaction with their experience with ammonia, and probably some of them at least have indicated that they will not likely go back to rubidium when it comes back to market.
So do you think rubidium has a future when all three of these products are available?
Oh yes, I think it has a future, and particularly as I indicated for higher volume labs, it will have a definite future.
And I would think that having three viable tracers, as it were, would actually grow the market, not restrict it. So, Dr. Dabala, what do you think the acceptance is of cardiac PET by your referring physicians? You've been doing this for a number of years as well.
Yes, I think it's been very well accepted by the physicians at the Brigham. We had to suggest to them which patients are good for PET, but right now we do receive requests asking for cardiac PET. The referring physicians are very well aware. They ask for PET in obese patients and in all the other patients that you had previously described. We do see a good number of referrals from our CT surgeons, from our interventional cardiologists, and heart failure and EP colleagues, covering all the indications for cardiac PET, for viability, sarcoid, for flow assessment, and all of these.
So that's kind of an exciting area when you think about FDG and these heart failure patients, and also I think we're experiencing the same thing. The sarcoid assessment is gaining some real strength in the field. Dr. Babin, you're doing that now? Or?
No, actually we're not, and I would like to ask you and Dr. Dabala about how do you select patients for a cardiac sarcoid assessment? I've also heard that your protocols differ somewhat between the two institutions, and perhaps you could address that for us as well.
Yeah, I think we do, and I think one of the problems is that there is sort of no national standard. We adopted some of the Japanese literature in which we block the routine uptake of FDG into the myocardium, so what is left are patients who have either no activity or sort of what we call patchy infiltrative activity, and that's been quite successful. The driving force in our lab are, in fact, electrophysiologists who have patients with heart failure and unexplained arrhythmias. So we not only do one test, but if it's positive, oftentimes they will change therapies and we'll do another test that could be negative 2 or 3 months later. So I think it's sort of a physiologic evaluation. And you're doing a different protocol.
Right, we are. And the referral pattern is the same. We get referral from the EP folks as well as from the heart failure doctors. The protocol that we use is primarily a high-fat, low-carbohydrate or zero-carbohydrate diet. We give them specific instructions for the dinner night before and for the breakfast as well. In our lab, some patients still get referred to cardiac MRI for sarcoid assessment. However, all patients that have either devices or that may need potential follow-up for future assessment after therapy, I think clinicians are leaning more and more towards cardiac PET as the initial study.
Is that the only advantage of PET over MR for sarcoid assessment?
That's a good question. In my mind, I think one advantage is the ability to follow patients after devices. But the other advantage is that with gadolinium, you image extravascular space, which could be inflammation or scar. Whereas by using PET, where we image perfusion and FDG, we are able to find mismatch patterns and more definitively figure out whether the patient has inflamed myocardium or scar as a result of sarcoid. So I think that's a big advantage of PET compared to MRI as well.
Well, that's a very interesting discussion about some complex patients. Dr. Bateman, maybe a few comments on your presentation of the future of nuclear cardiology. And so really give us a perspective on where you think PET fits into that.
Sure. Well, you know, PET imaging over the last 10 years has made tremendous inroads in terms of day-in and day-out myocardial perfusion imaging. The image quality is excellent, as you pointed out. There's additional information now in myocardial blood flow reserve that we cannot get with SPECT, and the prognostic information, as you have shown, is beginning to be very powerful and having direct influences on patient management. There's exciting investment in the PET field in terms of detectors as well as new radio tracers, as we've been hearing. I think the future of PET is a certainty. The question really is, how will it be utilized relative to some newer developments in SPECT as well? But in my opinion, advanced nuclear imaging labs in the future, cardiac imaging labs in the future, will have both PET and SPECT.
Good. Well, so we end on a pretty positive note then. Just a few final concluding remarks on each one of the presentations. For mine, I think that cardiac PET imaging provides a clinically significantly higher diagnostic accuracy in comparison to SPECT imaging, with a very rapid protocol and high-quality images. I think that's going to go a long way, particularly as Dr. Bateman is pointing out, for the future. Truthfully, cardiac PET imaging should be considered for all patients undergoing myocardial perfusion imaging. We stated a few of the patients who may not be ideal, but the thought process has to be there, particularly those recommended for pharmacologic stress. Dr. Darbala?
Yeah, for conclusions and take-home points, I think I would like to conclude by saying quantitation of myocardial perfusion with rubidium-82 and N13 ammonia PET is well validated with extensive data, and it's ready for clinical use. Several software packages are available, making this a clinical tool at this time. In patients with heart failure, F18 FDG imaging should be considered not only for viability assessment, but also for the diagnosis of suspected cardiac sarcoid, which is a potentially treatable cause of cardiomyopathy and ventricular tachycardias.
Dr. Bateman?
I believe that for our field to thrive going forward, we must substantially reduce the radiation exposure of our most commonly used protocols. Currently, solid-state SPECT for patients who can exercise and PET for those who need to be tested pharmacologically are the best options. Also, as we have heard in this discussion, PET has many advantages over SPECT for myocardial perfusion imaging. It is likely that PET will grow and SPECT will recede as optimal options for assessing integrity of myocardial perfusion.
Well, thank you. I'd like to thank both Drs. Timothy Bateman and Darbala for their terrific insights, and thank you in the discussion of the innovations of cardiac PET perfusion imaging. Please take a few moments to fill out the post-test to receive CME credit.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Innovations in Cardiac PET Imaging. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.